This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for March 24th, 2014. It was, as usual, a busy and an interesting week in the federal courts and with announcements of all kinds from the Internal Revenue Service, plus some interesting commentary by IRS officials. Let's start with United States versus Robert Schreiner, in which an estate's representative was found liable for his deceased relative's outstanding tax debt. Mr. Schreiner claimed he got bad tax advice, but he knew that there was a tax liability, but he distributed the assets of the estate anyway. We'll talk some more about that. The Health and Human Services Department has extended the individual health care mandate hardship exemption until October 1st, 2016, and we'll talk about the details of that. The first quarter effect of expired extenders is something of great concern to financial analysts. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. We picked up another article, this one from Tax Analysts, discussing the fact that first quarter results are going to be seriously skewed if a corporation, for example, had research credit in 2013, and there is no research credit in 2014, that tax item could make a big difference in the reported income. On the same subject, Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden is planning to hold a committee markup of tax extenders, probably the first week of April, if rumors are to be believed. And a news item that I know all tax professionals will delight in, Toyota cannot deduct the $1.2 billion penalty assessed against it for failing to notify consumers of defects in its acceleration system. The IRS is yielding to pressure. 143,000 comments have been received on the 501c4 proposed rules that we talked about here, specifically addressing the what appear to be restrictions on free speech in the IRS's attempt to regulate political activity. A group of appraisers has been barred from valuing facade easements for a period of 5 years. Information release 2014-31 gives us a few of the details. And then the IRS has yielded. They're going to follow the Bobro decision. An IRA rollover limit is going to be applied on an aggregate basis, not an IRA by IRA basis, as their proposed regulations and their instructions said, until the tax court said those proposed regulations and those instructions don't follow the statute. Finally, we have a great example of the doctrine of constructive receipt, where an estate is denied a refund of taxes paid on constructively received income. Where income was available, the personal representative simply chose not to access it. And it's your income in the year that it is available, not the year you take it. So that's the plan. We have a lot to do. Let's get started. In United States versus Robert Schreiner, a decision in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland, the court granted summary judgment to the government, finding that an individual's reliance on erroneous advice from an estate attorney was not sufficient to relieve him of a decedent's federal tax liability after he and a co-defendant distributed assets of the estate that rendered the estate insolvent. A key point here is that Mr. Schreiner and his co-defendant knew there was a tax liability, but they distributed the assets anyway. And there's some interesting verbiage here. In Chapman versus Merrill Lynch, the law firm's knowledge of the unpaid taxes is imputed to their clients. In Ryan versus Brady, even if plaintiffs did not know of the statements or omissions of defendant, it is clear that their attorney did. Such knowledge must be imputed to the plaintiffs. So in this case, there was no question that the attorneys knew there was a tax liability, and whether Schreiner knew, now Schreiner did know, but whether he knew or not, once he elected to be absolutely represented by attorneys, the knowledge of that the attorneys gained was imputed to him. Next, the individual health care mandate hardship exemption available to individuals whose policies were canceled because of noncompliance with the Affordable Care Act has been extended until October 2016. Back in November, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a letter to the state insurance commissioners outlining a transitional policy for non-grandfathered coverage in the small group and individual health insurance markets. They announced then that, if permitted by applicable state authorities, health insurance issuers could choose to continue certain coverage that would otherwise be canceled, and affected individuals and small businesses could choose to re-enroll in such coverage. They further stated that under the transitional policy, non-grandfathered health insurance coverage in the individual or small group market that is renewed for a policy year starting between January 1, 2014 and October 1, 2014 will not be considered to be out of compliance with certain market reforms if certain enumerated specific conditions are met. Now, the enumerated conditions, by the way, have not changed. All that has changed is that the transitional policy has been extended for 2 years to policies that are written in years beginning on or before October 1st, 2016. Included in the announcement are two attachments that are questions and answers for policyholders, which are required to be provided to policyholders who are exercising their right to an extended renewal under this particular program. Next, just in passing, this is for those of us that work on tax provisions. Recent tax reform and budget plans looking to make permanent several expired tax extenders have got companies and investors on tenterhooks because of the diminished financial reporting comparability that can arise with the absence of those provisions in the first quarter of 2014. At a March 6th House Ways and Means Committee hearing, Chairman Dave Camp argued that measures such as the research credit have been long-standing policy and should be made permanent. However, until policymakers agree on a long-term solution for the extenders, uncertainty remains, especially for financial reporting purposes. For example, a calendar year company that has previously benefited from an expired provision like the research credit could see a great disparity between its financial results for the first quarters of 2013 and 2014. A company's forecast of its annual income tax expense and effective tax rate used for the first quarter of 2014 would necessarily exclude any of the credits or benefits associated with an expired provision like the research credit or bonus depreciation, while its 2013 first quarter results included those benefits along with an adjustment made to account for the tax laws that were retroactively enacted in January of 2013. As a result of that accounting adjustment, a financial analyst or investor could essentially be comparing 5 quarters worth of research credit or bonus depreciation recorded in the first quarter of 2013 to no credit recorded in the 2014 first quarter, and that's going to be a problem. But all is not lost. Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden is planning to hold a committee markup of a tax extenders package in early April. In early April, we hear, is April the 2nd. We also hear that he's preparing a mark that would not renew some of the dozens of tax provisions that expired at the end of 2013. Such, and the prime example is the special depreciation rules for motorsports entertainment complexes that's commonly referred to as the NASCAR loophole. The next issue, of course, is that if an extenders package clears the Finance Committee and the Senate, as is really expected, its fate is going to be much less certain in the House. Ways and Means Committee Chair Camp has declined to take separate action on extenders because he is pursuing the enactment of comprehensive tax reform, which most experts say is, regrettably, unlikely. Next, according to an announcement on March 19th by the Department of Justice, Toyota Motor Corporation will not be allowed to write off its $1.2 billion penalty payment as part of the settlement. The $1.2 billion penalty is the largest of its kind ever imposed on an automotive company. That settlement is the latest in a string of high-profile cases, such as those involving J.P. Morgan Chase, in which the settling company was prohibited from deducting penalties. In November, J.P. Morgan agreed to a $13 billion settlement, including a $2 billion non-deductible penalty over its mortgage-backed securities practices. In January, the government imposed a $1.7 billion non-deductible penalty on J.P. Morgan for its role in the Bernard L. Madoff Ponzi scheme. In the president's recent budget proposals, we have a proposal, a provision that would disallow a deduction for punitive damages paid upon a judgment or settlement of a claim. Next, after receiving 143,000 written comments, the Internal Revenue Service has agreed to hold a public hearing on the proposed rules limiting the amount of political activity that a Section 501c4 organization may engage in. As you may recall, the proposed rules would amend current regulations to exclude candidate-related political activity, and this, of course, is where the battle is joined. The IRS's definition of candidate-related political activity would appear to infringe upon the right of free speech. And so it'll be an interesting ride. Let's keep track of how many people show up for the public hearing. If we get 140,000 of them, if we get half of those people, the hearings will go on for a decade. We've been reporting for some time on IRS victories in court on facade easement valuations. This news is not unexpected. This is Information Release 2014-31. The Office of Professional Responsibility has entered into a settlement agreement with a group of appraisers from the same firm who are accused of aiding in the understatement of federal tax liabilities by overvaluing facade easements for charitable donation purposes. In settling the case, the appraisers admitted to violating sections of Circular 230 related to due diligence and document accuracy and agreed to a 5-year suspension of valuing facade easements or performing any appraisal services that could subject them to penalties under the code. Which sections did they violate? Well, how did this happen? They prepared reports valuing facade easements donated over several tax years, and on behalf of each donating taxpayer, the appraiser would complete Part 3, Declaration of Appraiser of Form 8283, certifying that the appraiser did not fraudulently or falsely overstate the value of such facade easement. But in valuing the facade easement, the appraiser simply applied a fat percentage diminution, generally 15%, to the fair market values of the underlying properties prior to the easement's donation without really doing the necessary work. Specifically, in this settlement, the appraisers admitted to violating Circular 230, Section 10.22A1, they failing to exercise due diligence in the preparation of documents relating to IRS matters, and Section 10.22A2, for failing to determine the correctness of written representations made to the Department of the Treasury. Now, I submit that there are some tax return preparers and tax advisors who will be listening to this podcast who need to think about how they are going about the business of preparing tax returns and giving tax advice in this same context that the appraisers did not exercise due diligence in their work. For example, how many years can you sign a return for a client who is claiming losses on a Schedule C without requiring or without making some sort of reasonable inquiry into the client's support for those losses? Interesting question. Could you be cited for failure to exercise due diligence? Following their unexpected victory in Bobro, in which the IRS took the position that the limitation on transfers from an IRA applies on an aggregate basis, meaning, of course, that an individual could not make an IRA to IRA rollover if he'd made a rollover involving any of his IRAs in the preceding 1-year period. The tax court agreed with that position, even though it was contrary to the IRS position in proposed regulations and in IRS Publication 590. The IRS, as far as all of us knew, took the position that the limitation on rollovers from our IRA, the 60-day window, applied on an IRA by IRA basis, and that's what Mr. Bobro thought, until the tax court said, read the law. The law says aggregate, and sure enough, the IRS agrees now with the tax court. So, in Announcement 2014-15, the IRS has said it will interpret Section 408D3B, which provides an individual is permitted to make only one IRA rollover in any 1-year period, is imposing the limitation on an aggregate basis rather than on an IRA by IRA basis. The IRS will not apply this interpretation of the statute to any rollover that involves an IRA distribution occurring before January 1st, 2015. So we all have a little time to get used to the new rules. Finally this week, Anthony Santangelo, a co-executor of the estate of Natalie Santangelo, learned a hard lesson about the doctrine of constructive receipt. The decedent, according to the court, was in constructive receipt of funds and taxes were properly assessed in 2006 because the funds were available in that year, even though neither the decedent nor her daughter, who had power of attorney, attempted to obtain them. Natalie Santangelo, the decedent, owned 21,000 shares of the common stock of HCA Inc., divided into two certificates, one for 7,178 shares and one for 14,356 shares. Rather than turn the shares over to a broker or bank, she maintained possession of the physical stock certificates. In November 2006, HCA merged with Hercules Acquisition Corporation. As part of that merger agreement, all common stockholders were to receive $51 per share, and their stock would be canceled. Pursuant to the merger agreement, HCA was required to immediately deposit the funds with a paying agent, and there is no dispute that that actually occurred on November 20th, 2006. So on November 20th, 2006, all of the money to redeem Natalie Santangelo's stock was available. All she had to do was present the certificates, and she would receive $1,098,234. There was a little confusion with locating the certificates, but nothing was done prior to Natalie Santangelo's death on March the 29th, 2007. After her death, in November 2007, the stock certificate for 7,178 shares was located and redeemed, and the proceeds deposited in the estate account on January the 8th, 2008. The second stock certificate, 14,356 shares, was never found, and so the estate followed the steps outlined for a lost certificate and got the final payment on October 19, 2009. The estate is contending that it owes tax based on receiving the money. The tax should be calculated for the year in which the money was received, even though they filed a tax return reporting the income from a Form 1099 in 2006. In 2007, when they filed the return for 2006, now they want to file an amended return. They have a claim for refund. The co-executors insist the income should not have been claimed in 2006. The accountant who prepared the return made a mistake because the income was not actually received. Since the taxpayer could have accessed the money but simply did not do so, the doctrine of constructive receipt applies. It's recited this way: income, although not actually reduced to a taxpayer's possession, is constructively received by him in the taxable year during which it is credited to his account, set apart for him, or otherwise made available so that he may draw upon it at any time, or so that he could have drawn upon it during the taxable year if notice of intention to withdraw had been given. Income is not constructively received if the taxpayer's control of its receipt is subject to substantial limitations or restrictions. The court went on to cite Oliver versus United States, where the court in that decision, in the Oliver decision, expanded on the wording of the regulation. So if you need a good lesson on constructive receipt, the Santangelo decision does a good job of explaining how those rules work. Well, folks, it's a wrap for this week. Thank you. Stay safe.